Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Extremely special guest today on the phone from Houston, Texas, Dr. Gail Gross, who is a nationally recognized family child development and human behavior expert. She's an author, an educator. She's had her own radio show on PBS. She's been on every talk show known to man, including O'Reilly and Fox and NBC. She's been in newspapers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, you name it. She's been there, and that's because she's so good. What we're going to talk about today is her new book, The Only Way Out is Through. Wonderful title. Subtitle is A 10-Step Journey from Grief to Wholeness. It was published this year by my publisher, Roman and Littlefield. Gail Gross, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dio. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, thank you for taking the time, because I know you're in the middle of a book tour and you're going all over and you're doing wonderful things to promote a very worthy book. I loved it. I read it today all the way through except for the last 30 pages, and I can tell my listeners it's wonderful. But then, you know, a kind of note of sadness will creep in as I tell them why you wrote this book. And then I'll hand it off to you to tell the story. In 1990, in April, Gail Gross and her husband got a phone call out of the blue. They were visiting friends in the Bahamas, that their daughter, Dawn, who lived in Los Angeles, was dead. And as I read the book, I was deeply moved. I learned a lot that helped me and myself in my own life. And I was deeply impressed by the courage of Gail Gross in telling the story, and also her son, who contributes, Sean, who contributes a very powerful chapter of his own experience. And so this is a book that started with, as W.B. Yeats says in his poem, "The world's more full of weeping than we can understand." Gail Gross, you suggest at the beginning of your book that you went through all your education subsequently, including 2 doctorates, one in education and one in psychology with a concentration in Jungian studies, because of your experience of your daughter's death. Is that the case?
Well, I had started back to school for my doctorate in education, and I was in my first semester when Dawn died. Then I was going to stop school. I couldn't imagine going on, and had said to my chair that I just felt it was impossible for me to go on, and he said he'd give me a semester off, but that I would have to complete that semester. And this was April, and I couldn't imagine how I could do that. There was a paper left to go and one of my core subjects and a test. And he said, "Well, Gail, everybody has a story." And, of course, he was a psychologist.
Yes.
"Everybody has a story, and this is your story, and life goes on, and you have to figure out for yourself how to move through this. But there are only 6 places for your doctorate, and if you're not willing to go on, someone is waiting for your place." and very different than the world today where we talk to children about safe spaces and not having to take tests. It was a completely different philosophy. It was a philosophy of we all have stories, and this is your story, and you still have to go on.
Did you resent it at the time that he had such a kind of tough love approach?
Well, I actually said to him, I said, is this some form of tough love? I remember saying that to him. I said, I can barely get out of bed in the morning. I can barely wash my face. And he said, Gail, he repeated to me, everyone has a story, and this you'll find interesting. What had really brought me back to school at that period was I wanted to start a school for homeless children that our family and another family funded, were going to fund. And I wanted to really know what I was doing. So that's what brought me back in the first place. And he reminded me of that and of all these homeless children that really needed not just an education but a residence so that they would be safe and could then open to being educated. And so I had that in the back of my mind, and he reminded me of that. And so I sat for the test because I thought, well, you know, I was holding an A in the class, and you get a throwaway test. And I thought, well, if I just sign my name, they can throw the test away, and I just have to show up. And the paper that I had to write was researched. It just wasn't written down. And I sat down with the secretary in my husband's office and asked if she would help me. Her name was Marilyn, and she said, I said, I'm going to dictate to you, Marilyn, just type what I tell you. And so she did, and I was crying, and she was crying, and by the end of the day, she begged me not to hand this in. She said, it doesn't make any sense. Please don't hand it in. But I did hand it in just to meet the requirements because I knew I could never face it again. I was in complete shock having lost a child, and I was operating really on empty. I honestly don't know when I look back how I did that. But it made me be able to complete the course and not have to take an incomplete, which would have forced me to have to face this same event at the time of the anniversary of my daughter's death, and I knew that would have been impossible for me. So I just pushed through it, and the professor at the end of the day asked me for that paper. He just thought it was so interesting, and I would never let him have it because I knew if he ever reread it, it didn't make any sense.
Are you glad in retrospect that he was tough on you?
Yes, because the next part of the story is the most amazing, really, where he made, then, you know, the semester was over, the new semester started, I was still in terrible shape, worse shape by this point because I was coming out of shock. And he said, well, are you coming back to school? And I said, I'll try. So I went back to school, again reminding me of this thing, this reason I was in school, which was that I was trying to create a program for homeless children. So I sat in this class, and I was in the back of the room, and it was a philosophy course, and the professor was Dr. Miller. And he lectured, and I kept weeping, and he lectured, and I kept weeping. And at the end of the class, I went over to him, and I said, Dr. Miller, I don't belong back in school. My daughter just died a few months ago, and I really don't belong here. And he said, I know your story, Gail. I want you to come up to my office. I want to talk to you. And it turned out that he had been a minister, an Episcopalian minister, and his son had died. He was killed at a railroad crossing, and he was this brilliant student, senior in high school, had a brilliant future, wonderful boy, and he was just killed. And Dr. Miller decided he couldn't go on helping others because he couldn't help himself, and then it took him back to school, and he became a philosophy professor. So he said, I know your story. I can meet you at this edge. I've been there. And as long as you do your work and take your tests, I don't care if you weep behind your book in the back of the room. It's fine with me. I understand. And that was what my professor, Dr. Weber, had engineered
He put you in there on purpose.
He did that on purpose. And so that's how I went back to school. And the way I studied that first year was I would have to fill my bathtub with lukewarm or cold water so that I could focus because I was grieving.
Not hot water?
Not hot, but
Thomas Aquinas always used to use hot water when he was kind of depressed.
I know that. I did cold to keep me awake.
You're a brave soul.
And that was because I was so distracted by my grief that I had trouble concentrating. But the water kept me at an alert state, and that helped me. And that's how I went back to school. So I was one semester in when Dawn died, and I hadn't completed that first semester. And I went back, and then I went on and took a second PhD in psychology, then later in time. And this approach of service was what I had always thought of in my life. I always thought the first part of my life was growing up and being a daughter, and the second part was being a wife and a mother, but that the third part would be service. And so in a way, this really opened a portal for me to do the work that I had really meant to do but thought I could not complete any longer because of grief. On the other hand, it was the grief that showed me a path forward.
And that comports perfectly with the title of your book, The Only Way Out is Through.
Yes.
A 10-step journey from grief to wholeness.
Yes, I had met a professor in Hawaii, Dr. Aoki, Mitz Aoki, and he was the head of religious studies at the University of Hawaii. And I met him about 40 years ago, and he gave a week seminar. A very interesting fellow. He worked with Kubler-Ross on death and dying, and he was adopted, and he felt that he was really going to be a Buddhist, but he was adopted by a Christian minister who raised him as a Buddhist because that was what his religion was. And then he worked with Kubler-Ross with a dying woman one day, and she gripped his hand as she was dying. And in that moment, he felt suspended with her in this expanded consciousness. And when she let go of his hand, she opened her eyes, smiled at him, and died. And he converted to Christianity after that experience.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But he's the one who gave me that title. Because for that week seminar, what he told our class, as he taught our class, was that the only way out is through.
Well, let's start drilling down in this great book of yours. Again, I want to remind my listeners, I have Dr. Gail Gross on the phone from Houston, Texas. She's nationally known for her work. We're talking about right now grief and overcoming it, trauma and living through it. And her book is about how she did it. It's also about her family, her husband, her son. And then about her own studies, including that of the psychologist Carl Jung, but just a lot of good common sense and insights from various traditions of spirituality. She is Jewish. You are Jewish, Gail.
Yes.
But you talk about Christians and Buddhists and your own experience of Shiva. Now, I must say that... that one, I had heard of Shiva, but I'd never seen it described. And Shiva's the tradition of deal of mourning. Is that a good way to say it?
Yes. You spend a week in mourning. And, of course, you do things that, in a sense, define mourning. And the what I would call inversion period, that going inside. Mm-hmm. So you cover your mirrors so that you're not looking at your reflection, so that there's a sign of humility, and there's this feeling of the inner world rather than the outer world. And you have various rituals. People come and lighten your burden by sharing your grief with you in that week's period. And you do prayers for, you know, everyone is...
No, you skipped over tearing up your clothes.
Yes, renting. You rent your... lapel or a piece of your clothing really at the cemetery edge, and that's to remind your psyche, in a sense. Many of these things are very psychological, and it reminds the psyche that there is a wound, a tear on your heart that will heal but will always leave a scar.
And I think I've read of a lot of renting in the Old Testament, if not the New as well. Is that correct?
That's right. And it makes you remember that what very much a Jungian concept, which is only the wounded healer can heal. But it takes you deeply into the understanding that unless you've been to this edge, you really don't know what that experience of complete deconstruction is. But once you've been there, then you can extend your hand to others who are there, because you actually know what that is, to have such a blow to the psyche that the entire defense mechanism of your body, of your unconscious, is down, and you can't defend yourself against anything. You're very vulnerable. You feel very young. You do a lot of... regressing, going back to an earlier period, usually at about 7 years old, when you're helpless, really, because in the greatest sense, you are helpless. You come up against a problem you can't do anything about. Death is final in our earthly experience. I've now come to the conclusion that there is no finality in reality, that there are these other expanded consciousness experiences that we can have through prayer and contemplation and meditation that inform us that death is not the end, that we can go on and do go on.
And your husband, Gennard, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, exactly. Very good.
I was very struck by how he took charge.
Yes.
In spite of his incredible grief, that he stood tall, and I think your son describes that too in his chapter,
yes.
Sean.
That was
the
bravest thing I ever did, was let my son write a chapter.
Well, I must say it was very compelling.
Yes. You know.
And I think anyone who's listening who has lost a child, lost a sister or brother, even lost a parent too soon, will love this book and will relate to all of it. And this very, for a guy who claims not to be a private person, it's a secretive person and doesn't like crowds, doesn't like revealing himself, he let it all hang out in that chapter.
He did, and I thought it was important. I asked him to share his memoir because one of the most common things that happens when a child dies is that people focus on the parents, and the parents are so diminished and so stressed that they can't or it doesn't occur to them to think about their other children and in the way of their grief, because they feel that nothing could be, you know, nothing is worse than a parent losing a child, which is definitely true. On the other hand, siblings suffer their own hell and sadly are many times not recognized or noticed for their grieving simply because we're so caught up in our own. And so I asked Sean to write about his experience, because our perceptions are different when we're in shock, and of course first onset of grief is completely traumatizing to the psyche or the unconscious, and so our perceptions are quite different. And so that's why I asked Sean to do that. I thought it would be important for parents to recognize how siblings suffer and how they perceive things in a different way. You know, all memories are attached to our feelings, and we store our memories with our feelings. So in a sense, there are no true memories, and our perceptions are how we felt at the moment of loss, and that's how we store our memories. And so that's why I asked Sean to do that. And you're right, it was very, very powerful. It was the hardest book, the hardest part of the book for me to read.
You know, your foreword was written by Dr. Dean Ornish.
Yes.
And one of the most powerful moments in the book comes pretty soon when you notice that he's hanging around the house after the funeral.
Yes.
And you can tell he's struggling with something, and you go up and ask him, and he said, well, I didn't know whether to tell you this, but I saw Dawn on her coffin, or over her coffin.
Yes.
And she was saying to tell that story. That was riveting.
It was really a very powerful experience. And Dean, you know, several friends had stayed with me and my husband that night, and at our house. And Dean was supposed to leave the next morning to lecture at noon in California on heart disease. But he wasn't going to bed, and he was not making any movements to leave. And so I said, what's going on? And he said, you know, I struggled with telling you this. And he said, my wife told me that I should tell you, so I'm going to tell you. He said, I was just 10 paces away from the coffin, and I saw Dawn sitting on her coffin, emanating compassion to you and Jannard and Sean. And he said, it wasn't a flash of light. It wasn't a momentary image. He said, the image sustained for the entire service, which was an hour, graveside, because I felt that was as much as we could handle as a family. And he said it wasn't something that was questionable. It was very clear and succinct, and a clear and present image. And I've really have to say that it was very courageous of him to tell me that. And we've talked about it many times since. And it was very courageous for him to let me put it in the book.
But Gail, 2 years ago on this program, I had Bill Blatty, the author of The Exorcist,
mm-hmm.
who unfortunately passed away a year ago.
Uh-huh.
But he had written a book about his son's death by suicide.
Oh, my.
Entitled Finding Peter, A True Story of the Hand of Providence and the Evidence of Life After Death.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how Peter appeared both to himself and his wife, Julie.
Yes.
And so I immediately connected those things. Now, in your travels and conversations and so forth, have you found other instances of the same thing?
Yes, and, you know, I'll tell you something I hadn't intended to tell, but I will tell you the story since we're on this subject, this part of it. But after a year of Dawn's death, I was very forlorn, and I always did a lot of meditation. I really feel that contemplation, prayer, and meditation were my most powerful strategies, really, especially in the earliest parts. Because, of course, prayer and meditation give you access to your soul, and your soul is really the part of you that holds the resource for healing. And so I always pray before I meditate, and I was in my meditation room on my knees praying. And I had this profound experience, and it was an expanded consciousness experience. And I'll always believe it was an experience of a direct contact with God. And while I was on my knees, I was covered with light. And then from this light, I was told that Dawn's death was our destiny together, and that, to the contrary, it wasn't a punishment, that God was really holding me up through it. And beyond that, I was also given information that I could see Dawn in that moment. And though a moment before, I would have given my life to see her one more time, somehow in this expanded consciousness, I understood that it wasn't necessary. Somehow I understood something in that space that I didn't catch in the day-to-day living when you're distracted by life. And so I had that experience. And, you know, when you meditate and you pray, you open yourself more and more because you're touching or accessing your unconscious or your soul. And so these, you in a sense, fertilize the field, if you will, for more experiences. And the that which happens spontaneously can be brought on deliberately the more you have a practice. So I've always said that if I were dying and you were kind enough to be there saying goodbye to me, I would say meditate. My one word, meditate, because it includes prayer, but prayer alone is asking for something. Meditating is experiencing something.
It's going through.
That's right.
As you put it. We're going to take a very quick break. I'm talking Dr. Gail Gross, talk about time flying. That first half of this show went in a blink. We'll be back with Dr. Gail Gross and her book, The Only Way Out Is Through, after this short message.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Every couple struggles occasionally, but research shows that when healthy couples hit hard times, they don't settle for complaining to friends who will confirm their own opinions about their situation. They seek out new tools. They look for great relationship books to read together. They go on marriage retreats. They speak to a faithful mentor or pastor who has real wisdom to share. Or they contact a marriage-friendly counselor who can provide new skills. Too many couples either don't seek help until it's too late, or seek help from friends in the same boat who can't be helpful. If you're going through tough times, don't keep your marriage struggles a secret, but do reach out to those who can really make a difference. For more marriage-building ideas, check out my book, When Divorce is Not an Option, How to Heal Your Marriage and Nurture Lasting Love. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, why do we adorn, wear, and venerate crosses, once an instrument of suffering and capital punishment? It is because through this instrument, God gives us salvation and assures victory over evil.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Dr. Gail Gross, who's nationally known as a expert on child development, on grief, on the impact of trauma on families. She's been all over major media, including at times following classroom shootings and other tragedies which leave people desolate. Gail, there's so many angles that we could pursue about these 10 steps. But one that I want to get out right away is interpreting one's own dreams. Now, some people may listen and say, what's that about? Well, if you've read the Bible all the way through the scriptures, there are dreams and they are being interpreted and they're having a huge impact on the people of God and the leaders of the people of God. So, two very, how shall I put it, neophyte questions. Number one, how do you remember them? And two, how do you know if your interpretation is correct?
Well, you know, Deal, there are many kinds of dreams. There are dreams that translate to, I had something bad to eat last night, or I had a fight with a friend, or I have a business problem that I'm anxious about. That's one kind of dream. Then there are dreams, as Jung says, big and small, and we recognize the big ones because they have an energy or a charge to them. And that's really why we remember them, because they're highly charged. And even as we're dreaming, we know this is something that's important to us. And then in those dreams, we're really in dialogue with our unconscious. All day long, your unconscious is trying to have a conversation with you. And 98% of who you are is that unconscious. You know, following a Jungian model or even a Freudian model, Jung would tell us that the unconscious creates the ego, and the ego is just our function. It gets us up in the morning. It gets us to sleep at night. It gets us to work during the day, brushing our hair and our teeth, and all the functional things we need to do. But the unconscious is who we really are, and it's this depth of information. If in a spiritual context, we would say it's our soul, our deep psyche. It's who we really are. And it knows everything. It knows what's up, what's been, and how to deal with what's coming forward. And so to access that unconscious is really, you could say, one of the most important steps that we are called upon to follow in life, that consciousness is really what allows us to have free will and choice, and it's also what allows us to have options. So if you take the story of Adam and Eve before they ate of the apple, or whatever that fruit was, they were naive. They were unconscious. They didn't know they were naked. They didn't know about lying or shame. But as soon as they ate from the apple of the tree of knowledge, not of the tree of life, they were aware of life. They became conscious.
Self-conscious of their nakedness.
That's right. And what does God give them? He gives them, as he casts them out of the garden, he gives them free will, choice. Now, if they were not naive, if they were conscious, then choice counts. But if you're naive, free will wouldn't count because you wouldn't know how to make a choice or a decision. So you could say that all day long the unconscious is trying to get your attention to, for one reason really, to bring you to consciousness so that you can have free will, so that you can make deliberate choices. And all psychological illness is about projection. It's about reactive behavior. It's about being unconscious. In a sense, even pathology is about the unconscious spilling into consciousness, crossing that barrier, and, of course, being then it being necessary then to put it back where it belongs, into the unconscious. So dreams give us everything, and that is our access, and that is the language of the soul.
So how do you, again, how do you remember a dream? Is it, you have to develop the discipline of doing that?
There are disciplines to help you remember. If it's a highly charged dream, you're going to remember. If you don't pay attention to the signposts along the way from prior dreams, you'll get a nightmare. And that's actually a good thing, because
it's like, if you're not going to listen to me in a calm dream, I'm going to get you with a really horrible dream.
I'll make it intense so you'll remember. On the other hand, if you set intentions to remember, for example, before you fall asleep, in that quasi-sleep where you're not quite there, or even in meditation before you go to sleep, if you set the intention to remember your dream. Then, by the side of the bed, leave a notebook so that when you wake up, you write down just simple words that will cue you back to your dream.
Right.
And then, of course, there's a physical cue where you can put three fingers of your left hand on the medulla oblongata, right by your brain stem, and press three times. There's something really magical about the number three. I mean, there are numbers.
What happens when you do that?
That's a physical cue that gives the body a connection to the psyche, and you're saying, I'm setting the intention to remember my dream.
Okay.
So we've done.
How do you start interpreting one?
And
in a way that isn't just gobbledygook.
Yes. Well, the best person to interpret your dream ultimately is you. But until you learn what the universal language of dreams is, until you learn that, it's gobbledygook. But there are there is a collective language. There are collective symbols that are the same. This is a lot of Joseph Campbell's work.
Right.
No matter where you live in the world, whether you're an African Bushman, or you live in China, or you live in Europe, or you live in America, the symbols are very much the same.
So postmodernism hasn't invaded dream interpretation.
No. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you've read any of Sir Lawrence Vanderpoest's work. He was a friend of mine, actually. And he wrote a lot about the African Bushman. And he was raised in South Africa, and he knew the Klik language. And he talks about their symbols and how similar not only their symbols, but their stories were. And, of course, Joseph Campbell showed that wherever you lived in the world, our myths, our stories, our symbols are the same.
Well, Mircea Eliade, the Romanian, did a lot of that.
Yes,
as well.
Exactly. And so to learn the symbols gives you a way to work your dream. And that's the most important thing. When you have a dream, first write it down. And then work it. And work it means to bring it to consciousness. So I tell people, even if they just draw stick figures, draw your dream. You know, I once had a dream about a turtle. It was a green turtle. So I drew a big childlike green turtle. And then I was in a store and they had these little beanbag turtles. And I bought one of those and I put it on my windowsill so that I was bringing to my unconscious mind the cue from my conscious mind that I was paying attention, give me more information. And that's how you work your dream. You, in a sense, bridge back to the unconscious. And by bridging back, the unconscious gives you more information. And ultimately, you recognize that each dream has a key. And the key to the dream is actually the advice from the unconscious telling you how to approach the next step of whatever you're dealing with.
You know, Gail, the few times in my life that I've had dreams that I clearly remembered and sought to read, I found the meaning fairly obvious.
And that is also true.
And I can remember, and this happened to me in graduate school, and I was at Emory working on my doctorate, the dream where I was at my childhood home in Fort Worth, Texas, and these loading trucks kept coming up my driveway with boxes, and they were boxes of books. And I was taking them in my teenage bedroom, and all over around the walls were Greek sentences were written, smeared on the wall.
Yes.
And I was looking, I couldn't read the Greek, I was frustrated, and by that time in my life, I could read a little Greek. And then I was pulling volumes of Kierkegaard out of these boxes, and I couldn't read it either. And I had this dream three nights in a row, and each night it got more and more details.
Interesting. Something so powerful about the number three. Jung said, if you dream three times, pay attention, it's truth. The same thing, three times, pay attention, it's truth. Because there's something very significant. You have the Trinity. You have the idea of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. There's such power in the number three that it actually is a symbol out of our unconscious that holds a charge for us. And so when you dream something three nights in a row, it's very important.
I want to give our listeners an idea of your, and we're flying pretty high. I want to give our readers, our listeners, I should say, a little idea of the practical advice that you give throughout the book. You have lists of sort of to-do items, and I'm not sure which one to read from, but here, for example, here is one list. Take care of physical needs, surrender to grief, which seems to be a theme throughout the book, commit to life, list one action you can take right now to affirm your life, and believe me, having gone through major trauma in my life, that's a big deal to be able to do that.
Yes.
Ask for help and know who to ask. Have rituals for saying goodbye.
Yes.
And then you talk about the importance of keeping a journal, the importance of routine, but you also talk about the future, about what are the three things you want to complete in the future, that, and you make that explicit, because you talk about diaries, journals, get all these things out, externalize them on paper.
Yes, because at the end of the day, you know, people that grieve can live again. Now, you won't live the way you did before. That is over. You know, you're changed forevermore, but you can actually live more vitally than you did before, because you're now aware, like that Garden of Eden. You're not naive anymore. You now know that life is fragile, that every day is precious and important.
Yeah.
And it may be the only day we have, so that if we live in the present, that's the correct way to live. Our memories aren't real, you know, they're attached to emotion, so the past is really gone, and you have to figure out strategies to help you move forward into life. And most people suppress their grief because it's too painful to face. When they suppress it, they have to use their energy to do that. And the energy that they're using is their creative energy. But if they don't suppress their grief, if they let it up, then that energy is returned to them to move forward into a larger life, really. But the way to look at it is, we are a personality. I like to say, think of a little container or a set. And when at the first moment we hear that someone we love has died, or that we've lost a job that we loved, or we're having a divorce, or our best friend doesn't want to see us anymore, whatever the crisis is, that makes a crack, if you will, in that container that holds our personality. And we're cast out of that space,
yeah,
momentarily into a place without familiar structures. I call this place the Valley of Despair.
Yes.
In most psychology lessons, it's called the neutral zone. And when you're thrown into this Valley of Despair, which I don't see as neutral, you are in unfamiliar territory, and therefore you're vulnerable and frightened and very much alone. And most people cannot hang out there in that Valley of Despair. They go back to what's familiar, and they go back to the old container, which now is cracked. And by going back, they're required to suppress what's happened to them. But if, and that's signing their own death warrant, really, because then life no longer will hold the vitality, or the mana, if you will, as they say in Hawaii, or the zest for your future.
So they're going back to toxicity, right?
That's right. But if they hang out in the Valley of Despair and do inner work there, be by yourself. That's very important, because this is an inversion process. You know that line in the Bible where God says, "Be still
and know that I am God."
Right. You have to go into an inversion process. And you, in this inversion process, you journal so that you connect to your unconscious. You keep a dream journal so you connect to your unconscious. You walk, you listen, you pray, you meditate, listen to music. all things to be by yourself, so that ultimately through inner work, and meditation to me is the most important piece of being with yourself. Little by little, you move forward. You are unaware at first that you've expanded, and you've expanded now into a larger container. And it's always larger and always better than the one you left behind. But you must hold the tension of your grief in that valley of despair. That's actually the key. Not to do anything, and that's where the surrendering comes in. Not to do anything to change your predicament, but to sit and experience your feelings.
What about this critical voice in your head? You mentioned that, because how do you deal with that?
It's very important to confront that inner voice, that critical voice. You know, there's definitely it is pulling you back to those earlier periods of low self-esteem and of the earlier you. There are many trees in our forest. There's the wounded child you, and we can never heal the wounded child. It always exists, but it's an important tree in our forest. Then there's the adult tree, and then there's the greedy tree and the generous tree and the compassionate tree. As Freud said, that's the human dilemma. That's what it is to be human. These are all parts of who we are, but we don't have to, and we can choose not to act upon these parts. And that's where free will and free choice comes in. So when we're in this valley of despair and we're doing our inner work, and these voices come up, we confront them and we say, you know, that's not who I am anymore. That's my vulnerable child person. That's not my adult. And you reach for your adult, which the child has no capacity to save you, but the adult part of you does. So you reach for your adult by holding the tension, confronting that voice, and doing the inner work. Also yoga and qigong, which brings it to some physical experience. Mm-hmm. Because when we connect the physical, yoga means yoke. When we yoke the physical to the emotional, then we're remembering that we can't cut our head off at our neck, that we're one complex.
Well, golf is my yoga. Yeah.
Well, that's right. And it connects you, body and soul, doesn't it?
You know, you have one thing in here that I did spontaneously in my time of grief.
Yes.
You said write an obituary of yourself.
Yes.
I actually did that.
Very important. And in, you know, further on in the book, it talks about writing such an obituary because you're, and also writing a history. You know, in primitive cultures, shamans do what they call recapitulate. They make an historical accounting of all of their memorable experiences so that they can now let them go. And then they go through rituals to let them go, because it's very important. Every ending signals a beginning, but there have to be demarcations for endings. We have to say, this wall has come down between me and adolescence. This wall has come down between adolescence and adulthood. And in a sense, we have to have rituals that define endings, transitions, and transformations. And primitive cultures that are more natural and in touch with nature and with their more natural self recognize this, and they all do this. And so this is what you would, as something that you can easily do. And you can create your own ritual of ending so that you can then become conscious of beginning. And when you write an obituary, you're aware of what you've done and what you wish to have accomplished that you didn't do, what still is of value to you that you are interested in. And it also helps you look at the way your family of origin operated, which is the most important because it informs the way you handle grief, the way you handle endings and beginnings. And if you can recognize that and acknowledge it, then you can separate from it. And when you separate from it, you can look at it objectively. When you do that, then you can integrate it back so that these things that we project out onto other people, those things from our family of origin, the way of behaving, those patterns that we learned in our childhood, instead of projecting them out, now we can consciously and deliberately make a home for them within our own psyche. But doing it deliberately helps us know that it's there rather than suppressing it. And once we know it's there, we can let it peacefully be there, knowing we can always resurrect it whenever we need or want. But if we leave it there, then we don't have to project it out onto others because it's consciously placed in our and integrated in our psyche. And that's individuation. That's how we move consciously into transformation. And the part of that that is in the alchemy chapter is the transcendent function. And this was very Jungian, where Jung said, what happens in alchemy is what happens in the psyche. And that's when he used alchemy as a model. In fact, he felt it had everything to do with the crucifixion of Christ, that he was the perfect person and that he still had to go through the shadow. He still had to go through suffering and had to go through it consciously.
Had to go to purgatory, had to descend into hell.
And he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, because he's aware, he's conscious of what's happening. And so this is the image of the alchemical model, not just light, but shadow and light, and that we have to unite that split within ourselves of shadow and light. We have to recognize that the shadow material, that which we've disowned, is what actually is in the valley of despair that we ultimately confront when we confront those critical voices.
And make it into gold.
That's right. And when we face the shadow, that's where all the fertility is for our growth. And so Christ teaches us that we have to unify shadow and light by the journey that he took off the cross. And that journey is the journey to enlightenment, or Jung would say individuation. That cross would be the philosopher's stone, and that would be what alchemy would call finding gold.
Gail, we're a few minutes away from, unfortunately, the end of our hour together, and we're approaching the 18th anniversary of your daughter Dawn's death.
Actually the 28th anniversary.
Oh, of course. I'm terrible at math.
28th, of course.
28th. Yeah, 1990. And where are you in your journey?
Well, you know, the journey continues because grief is a process. And we each have our own rhythm and our own ebb and our own flow. And the most important thing is to let yourself have that ebb and flow. So it makes you very self-actualized. If I feel happy and want to be with others, I expand and go out and I interact with others or write a book or go on a lecture tour or whatever. When I feel that I want to be quiet or want to be with my thoughts, I invert. I go inside and I allow myself the process. And that's the key, to become self-actualized. It's never about other people. It's always about you. And therefore, it's your journey. And so if you meet yourself and you honor yourself, you know, in the Ten Commandments, love thy neighbor like thyself. If you love yourself and you honor yourself in this process, then you will live again. You know, not just live, but live vitally. And in my 10 strategies, when I wrote them, I thought of the 10 commandments. You know, in the 10 commandments, God doesn't say, as a prelude to the 10 commandments, do these things, but if you don't do them, I will punish you or stone you or take your life or curse you. No, the prelude to the 10 commandments is that God says, do these things and you will live a better life.
Right.
And so I say about these 10 strategies, if you can allow yourself this journey consciously and deliberately and self-actualized, then you will live a better life.
Dr. Gail Gross, you are some lady. The book is the only way out is through a 10-step journey from grief to wholeness. Roman and Littlefield just came out. Great book. I recommend it to my listeners for all the reasons we've been discussing. And Gail, thank you for taking time out to be with me today on Church and Culture.
I really enjoyed it, and you're a wonderful interviewer, and I've always wanted to meet you, and so we finally have.
We have, and we will.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gail. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with another guest.